Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hello, and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. And this week, we have a treat in the form of a conversation with Daniel Kahneman, the most influential and respected psychologist in the world. He's one of a small number of non-economists to have won the Nobel Prize for Economics for his contribution to the School of Behavioral Economics with his collaborator Amos Tversky. He also wrote what I'm sure is the best-selling psychology book of all time, Thinking Fast and Slow. Along with Olivier Siboney and Cass Sunstein, he has a new book just coming out in paperback, Noise, The Flaw in Human Judgment. Olivier is a professor of strategy and business policy at HEC Paris, and I'm pleased to say he joined us for the interview. But I started by asking Kahneman to tell us what this great flaw in human judgment was that he calls noise.
I should define what noise is in relation to its cousin, more familiar cousin, which is bias. And we talk in general about errors of judgment. And the context when we talk about errors of judgment is to compare judgment to measurement. That's where the whole notions of accuracy and accuracy of measurement and error, the rigorous treatment of errors stems or from the comparison of judgment to measurement. Now, in measurement, when you're measuring the same object multiple times with a very fine ruler, say, you're not going to get the same result every time. That is, if the ruler is fine enough, there's going to be variability. That variability, that's the variability that we call noise. So the errors, some errors are positive, other errors are negative, and the variability of the error is noise. The average error is a bias, so that you can have positive bias or negative bias. And it turns out that in the discussion of errors of judgment, we have focused on systematic errors, on biases, and very little attention has been paid in the discussion of error to noise, to variability. But in the theory of measurement, bias and noise actually have equivalent weight, and there is reason to believe that more inaccuracy in judgment is often due to noise than to bias. And this is, you know, where the book came to be.
And I guess it's worth saying we're used to thinking of the bias that you'll be systematically leaning in one direction or another in the directions that we, in the decisions that we take. But I guess the point of the noise is that it's not predictable. And I guess crucially, we fail to understand not just that there is noise, but the extent of the noise. We ask experts something and we expect there to be only a relatively small variation in their decisions. And actually, there's a huge variation. So I guess it's worth talking through one of those examples just to give a sense of what you're talking about.
I can describe the example from which this study began. And it began about 8 years ago when I was doing some consulting in an insurance company. And I conducted a fairly routine experiment that today we would call a noise audit, where cases were constructed which were very common representative of the work of underwriters in that company. And then the same cases were presented to several dozen underwriters, about 50 as I recall. And we looked at the variability. We looked at, they put a dollar value on those cases. Now notice, those cases were fictions. They were constructed as such, but they were very typical. And the idea was that if underwriters vary in their judgments of those hypothetical cases, they would also vary in their judgments of real cases. Now, I asked executives in the company a question that I think anybody who is listening to this should also ask themselves. If you look at two underwriters and you pick at random, and how large a difference do you expect to find between them in percentages? That is, you take the two underwriters, you compute the average of their judgment, the difference of their judgment, you divide the difference by the average. What percentage do you expect? Most people, or many people, there is a really common answer to that question. People expect about 10%. And this was also true of the executives in that company. We don't expect judgments to agree perfectly, but we expect them not to disagree wildly. Now, the real number that we observed in the experiment was about 50%. 50, five times larger than expected. And that's really the origin of the book. So it looked worth studying, not only because there was a lot of noise, but because the noise came as complete news to the organization. They were unaware that they had a noise problem. So we started with a slogan, which is, and it turned out that there's a lot of noise everywhere, that wherever there is judgment, there is noise, and there is more of it than you think. And that is really the motivation for the book. Olivier joined me very soon, and we started working on the book together. Cass joined us later, and that's the story. And a year ago, the book came out.
It is interesting, you know, obviously you're from different fields. And Olivia, I'm interested in, you are drawn to this because obviously it has very clear relevance for business strategy and the way companies think about sort of what it is they're doing.
Well, as Denny has just described it, noise is unwanted variability in judgments. And this only becomes a problem when you're an organization. Noise is a disease of organizations. If you are an individual, we'll never know how noisy you are. You are noisy, by the way. I mean, you are subject to the same sources of noise that we are all subject to in organizations. But where we expect consistency is when people in an organization are making judgments on behalf of the organization, as in the example of the underwriters that Denny was just talking about, and when we expect those judgments to be reasonably consistent. If you look at another example we've looked at, which is the judicial system, we expect that the decisions that judges render should not be too dependent on the identity of the judge. Of course, again, we expect some variability, but we expect general consistency. And the challenge for organizations of any kind is to actually achieve something approaching consistency, because first, they need to realize how much inconsistency they have. They need to realize how much noise there is. And as Denny pointed out, they are not aware of that. It comes as a complete surprise when they realize that. So it's a huge organizational problem for private enterprises, but also for administrations, for government, for non-government organizations, for any organization of any kind that has many people making judgments and that expects consistency.
There's so many different strands of this. I mean, there's one which is a straightforward sort of natural justice perspective. Some of the examples in the book, some of the ones that perhaps we're most familiar with, is the variation in sentencing for the same case, depending on whether the judge's football team won or lost at the weekend or whatever it may be. But it also raises a question about what is the nature of expertise. If we like to think that experts are experts in part because they understand a body of knowledge and have a shared understanding of that
the way the world works in that particular expertise. You know, what a lot of these examples suggest is that they're all experts in their own way and they're all coming up with completely different conclusions. Does one come away from this thinking that experts are not necessarily helpful for organizations?
I think you come away thinking that there's really two different sorts of experts and that we should be clearer in our articulation of that distinction. There are experts whose track record can actually be evaluated, whose expertise can be quantified, measured against the gold standard. So if you're a forecaster and you make short-term economic forecasts, and each quarter we can check how off you were, and it turns out that your forecasts have historically been very good, we can say you're a true expert at forecasting. Now, if you're making 30-year forecasts, how much of an expert you are does not depend on how good your forecasts are. It depends on how much respect we accord you as a forecaster. And those are the experts that we call respect experts, because they're experts not because they have demonstrable expertise, but because they have convinced others of their expertise, because we have respect for their expertise. That is not a criticism of those experts, by the way, because in many fields, all you can be is a respect expert. Even the underwriters that Denny was talking about, we'll never know if they've actually set the right premium for an insurance policy. So we have respect for them because they are convincing, because they can articulate their reasoning in a compelling manner, because they have experience, because they have gained confidence in the way they do their job. But they are not the same sort of experts as the experts whose expertise can be demonstrated. And what we argue in Noise is that it's important to know what sort of experts you're dealing with when you're dealing with experts.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Danny Kahneman, you talk about good decision hygiene as being the sort of equivalent of washing your hands to, so that you can have the limited infection from noise. What does that look like for a policymaker or an organization?
Well, the whole notion of decision hygiene is in contrast to common efforts at debiasing, at trying to reduce various biases in the thinking or the judgment of organizations and individuals. Debiasing is very much like medication or vaccination. It's specific to a particular disease. Hygiene, like washing your hands, is non-specific. That is, you don't know what germs you're killing. If you're lucky, you'll never know. And that's the nature of hygiene. And when you think about noise, the only way that we could think of improving judgment, of reducing noise, is by taking steps which are generally steps to improve the quality of judgment, but are not oriented to particular biases or to combat particular biases.
What would be a good example of good hygiene where you could otherwise have a very noisy and unfair decisions?
A standard example, and actually an example that was very influential on our thinking, is how to conduct hiring interviews. And there has been a lot of research on hiring interviews, and they fall into two broad families. Unstructured interviews, that's the common procedure, where you talk to the candidate, you try to form a general impression, you have a conversation with the candidate, there is some human contact, and at the end of the process, you make a decision or you form an impression of that candidate. A structured interview is very different. In a structured interview, you have a list of topics that you want to think about. For example, you want to assess various attributes of the candidate, how original, how reliable. There are many attributes that may be relevant to a particular job. And in a structured interview, you think about each of these areas in turn, and you conduct an interview, that is, you ask questions that pertain to that particular area. Actually write down a grade or a ranking or rating for that before switching to the next topic. So that's a structured interview. Now, it turns out that neither kind of interview is very good because basically performance on jobs is very difficult to predict, and it doesn't depend only on the characteristics of the individual. But structured interview are distinctly superior to unstructured interview. And so structuring is, we think, a good idea. And when you're making a decision and you're considering various options, you might want to consider the options as if they were candidates and assess the various attributes of an option. And the important feature here is that you delay the global intuition. You delay the formation of a global impression. Intuition, one of the problems of intuitive thinking is that it comes very fast. We form first impressions, and in unstructured interviews, typically an impression is formed very quickly, and most of the rest of the conversation is to justify the initial impression. In a structured interview, that's not the case. You deal with topics one at a time, and you try to delay the global view of the candidate until all the information is in. So that's an example of decision hygiene.
But, I mean, one of the points about intuition is it's not very controllable. So I'm just wondering, I mean, you know, you and Olivier and behavioral economists may be very aware of all the biases and all the noise that you've just talked about. But when you're sitting interviewing a candidate or a potential colleague at university or whatever, how do you actually stop yourself from having a first impression of someone? Because by definition, a first impression comes unbidden.
Oh, you will undoubtedly form a first impression, there is no question. But if you have a set of questions that you want to ask about the person's reliability or about the extent of their experience on similar tasks, those specific questions are going to fill your mind. And they're going to push the intuition aside to some extent. And you will have an opportunity that you normally do not have of disconfirming your initial impression, of finding things out that actually do not fit the initial impression. In general, in unstructured interview, impressions are self-reinforcing. You justify your initial impression. And that is a source of noise. And by structuring the process, you reduce that source of noise.
An additional thing you can do to limit the problem that you're pointing out, Stephanie, is to have different people or different sources of information evaluate the different dimensions that you are looking at. So if you're evaluating candidates for, you know, intelligence, technical skills, and fit with the culture of the company. Let's assume these are the three dimensions of your job description. In an unstructured interview, you would form an overall picture of the person and you would then rate them on the three dimensions, but they would be strongly correlated with each other because there would be a positive or a negative halo around the person and you would, you know, say they are great on everything or they're bad on everything. Now, suppose that we say, you, Stephanie, are going to conduct the interview about the technical skills, or maybe, in fact, we're going to have a technical test to evaluate the technical skills. Someone else is going to evaluate the fit with the company. And someone else is going to evaluate how smart the person is. Or again, perhaps we're going to have a test of how smart the person is. Now you've got three independent data points that do not influence each other. And you have a much more structured process to make your decision.
You will have been asked this before, but of course, a lot of people entering the job market now find that they're at least the first couple of rounds, depending on how popular the job is and they're talking to a computer, or there is an AI element to their application process. We may not like it. We may think it's not true to our great sense of intuition about people. But from a fairness perspective and from a decision hygiene perspective, is that a better way to go?
We need to be careful here, because there is an answer in principle and there is an answer in practice. In principle, any form of structured decision making that reduces noise would, in fact, enhance the quality of the decisions. So if you have an algorithm making decisions, there is going to be less noise there. But of course, the question is, how good is that algorithm? How good are those AI systems that people sit in front of? And I'm sure there are good ones. But from the ones that I've seen personally in my admittedly limited experience, there isn't much evidence, and there isn't very good quality evidence that what these software packages are testing for is actually what you're looking for. It's actually quite hard for most companies to define what it is that they're looking for. And there is no evidence that I've seen that there's any correlation between what those software packages look for and job success is actually highly correlated. So in practice, I'm quite skeptical about what I see in the market. In theory, I have to agree that it makes some sense, but my worry is that companies are using this mostly to save time and money, not to actually improve the quality of their decisions.
Here, I would hope that what is true in theory can be made true in practice. One characteristic of algorithms is that they're improvable. They're much more improvable than people are, and they can be corrected by data on quality. They can be made to predict more accurately. So this is really an issue of the quality of constructing algorithms. And there are many algorithms that are of poor quality out there on the market. And there is a widespread suspicion of algorithms, which makes us prone to reject them. But by and large, I think this is the future. In the future, there will be more and more of those algorithms, and their quality will be getting better and better every year, because there will be data, there will be feedback, and the feedback can be incorporated into an algorithm much more efficiently than it can be in human judgment. So here, I join Olivier's skepticism about most of the algorithms that exist. But I really want to register a note of optimism about the future of that kind of operation.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
There's one trend which is about eliminating the human element to some extent, or at least having it in a more regular form of, in an algorithm. a more consistent form, structured. But of course, the other big trend in business strategy and conversations about companies is the move is encouragement of diversity and to encourage businesses, in a sense, to have a wider variety of humans doing the judgment. And I wonder whether that even goes against some of the things that you're talking about. You know, one of the ways that companies might have previously eliminated noise, not necessarily error, but noise, would have been having lots of identical people all making the decisions, all of these white men sitting in their boards. If you now have a great, much more diversity, you might be more true to the range of human experience, but you'd be getting a lot more noise.
Well, that is certainly true. But in principle, we want to distinguish between the process of generating a judgment and the final judgment. In the process of generating a judgment, diversity is very welcome. That is, you want multiple points of view, you want people with expertise to enter into the, to participate in the conversation. But when a final judgment is made, we want a process that reduces noise. So diversity is very useful. And you know, you can think of that in terms of, say, witnesses to a crime. So you are better off if the witnesses are in different places and see the event from different perspectives. And you're certainly better off if the witnesses don't talk to each other and are independent of each other. And so thinking along those lines gives you an idea that you do want diversity, but you want also the kind of independence and the kind of goal-directedness that reduces noise in the final judgment.
Diversity in the outcome of those decisions, in the judgment that you produce in the end, is good for some things, but for most it's not. When you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you, oh, you have this disease, and then you go to another doctor and he tells you you have that disease, you don't say, oh, that's wonderful, it's diversity. You say one of these two doctors is wrong, maybe both. So whenever we think that there is a correct answer, diversity in the outcome is not good. Maybe the way to get to the correct outcome is to harness the diversity of the perspectives of your multiple witnesses. And that is one of the remedies that you can have to reduce noise. But as an organization, what you're aiming for is not every person having their own opinion. It's any person having the best possible judgment.
And we've talked about business, we've talked about justice, or you know, sentencing and decisions within the criminal justice system. An area that comes up a little bit in your book, but obviously is kind of front and center of people's minds at the moment when we think of the decisions being taken around the war in Ukraine, is that in the critical moments of foreign policy or military strategy decisions, you know, you can't necessarily enlist a lot of people and listen to their structured answers on a set of questions in reaching your judgment about how to respond to Russia, or how to respond to one of the sort of the very pressing situations that can arise in foreign policy. So I just wondered whether you'd reflected on that. You know, if you're Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, or if you're President Biden, or for that matter, a Russian general. What does decision hygiene look like in those kind of situations where there's inevitably going to be a limited number of people that you can call on and imperfect information?
Decision hygiene is something that an individual can follow. That is, there are better and less good ways of reaching individual judgments. You want to cover all the bases. You want to think. You want, to the extent possible, to think of all possible consequences. You know, a salient example in the Ukraine war is it looks unlikely that people who started that war knew that Finland and Sweden would want to join NATO because, you know, after all, this was supposed to keep NATO away. So one had the feeling that not all the bases were covered in making those critical decisions. So there are... All we can hope for is that we have people with a lot of experience, because it turns out that there is genuine intuitive experience that can develop over time within certain kinds of decisions and choices. And we also want people who, even under some time pressure, can follow the basic dictates of decision hygiene.
I've noticed, Professor Kahneman, that a lot of interviews with you are quite long, longer than they sort of the norm for whatever program it is. And I suspect it's because it's always so fascinating to listen to you, and you always want to have another question. But we're going to run out of time. So thank you very much for coming on Stephanomics, and thank you to Olivier Sibony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this episode of Stephanomics. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, do please rate the show if you like it, and check out the Bloomberg Terminal and News website for more economic news and views on the global economy. You can also follow @economics on Twitter. This episode was produced by Magnus Henriksen and Summer Sadi, with special thanks to Professor Daniel Kahneman and Olivier Sibony. Mike Sasso is executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.